Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone, and Happy New Year. Okay, tonight we will begin the study of a new sutta. This is called the Great or Larger Discourse on the Destruction of Craving. This is Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 38, beginning on page 349. And the beginning of this sutta is somewhat similar in structure to the beginning of the Alagadupama Sutta, the sutta that we studied just before the Christmas break, and that it begins with one monk adopting a wrong view, the monks trying to dissuade him from that wrong view until he eventually comes before the Buddha and gets a good scolding from the Buddha. Okay, in this case, it's a wrong view that arises to a bhikkhu named Sati, who is said to be the son of a fisherman. And this view, it's also described as a papakadittigattam, that is, a pernicious view. And here the view is expressed thus: as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. Okay, the exact wording of this wrong view is very important, as we will see. Okay, now, as this monk named Sati is propagating this wrong view, the monks hear about it, they go to him. First they ask him whether it's true that he's teaching this view. When they hear that he is teaching it, then they try to detach him from that view. They question him, cross-question him. They criticize him. They ask him, please do not misrepresent the Blessed One. It is not good to misrepresent the Blessed One. The Blessed One would not speak thus. For in many ways, the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition, there is no origination of consciousness. Okay, now by presenting these objections, what the monks are indicating is that Sati is taking the view that there is a consciousness which is independent of conditions, a consciousness that exists in itself, independent of conditions, that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, existing in itself retaining its identity through the changes that it undergoes. And in Sati's view, this is a very important phrase that he uses. If we look at the view, he says, what he understands to be the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One is that it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. Tangyeva vinyanang. And this underscores the fact that in Sati's view, that it is consciousness retaining its identity, the same consciousness that does, a consciousness that does not undergo change, a consciousness that does not undergo any transformations, but a consciousness that remains the same entity, going from one state, from one experience to another within a lifetime, the same consciousness that goes from one life to another, sangsarati, sangdavati, sangsarati, that runs on, that roams on from one life to another through the round of rebirths. And now the Buddha also teaches that consciousness is the vehicle, I call it the channel or vehicle for the rebirth process. That consciousness continues through the rebirth process, according to the Buddha as well. And so if one just reads this superficially, one might get the idea that Buddhism is rejecting the continuation of consciousness beyond death and is holding that consciousness comes to an end at death. And so what the Buddhist monks are criticizing Sati for holding that consciousness continues beyond death, for holding that consciousness transmigrates to a new state of existence. But that is not the point of their criticism. In the Buddha's view, consciousness does continue from life to life, but consciousness continues as a changing process, an ever-changing process. But in the view of Sati, consciousness continues as an unchanging subject of experience. An unchanging, he doesn't use the expression here, but it continues as an unchanging self, an Atman. Exactly how this view of an unchanging self, an unchanging subject, is undermined by the teaching of the dependent arising of consciousness, this will become clear a little bit later in the sutta. But for now, let's go back to the drama that's unfolding here. Okay, the monk Sati is questioned, cross-questioned by the monks. Okay, we're on page 349, the bottom of 349. But even though the monks bring forth many arguments, they're not able to convince him to give up his view. He seems to have been a very, we call him a pig-headed, stubborn fellow. And so he thought that he had the right interpretation of the Buddha's teaching. The commentary says that, I think this is just invention on the part of the commentary, but it says that he was a specialist in the Jatakas, the Jataka stories. So according to the Jataka stories, the Buddha says, in such and such a past life, I was the wise parrot. In such and such a life, I was King Sibi. In such and such a life, I performed such and such a deed. And so, because Sati specialized in the Jatakas, which related the stories of the Buddha's past lives, he thought that there must be a consciousness which continues the same from life to life. And therefore, he grasped on this idea, and he must have been appealing to these Jataka stories as proof for the view that it's the same consciousness that continues on. Okay, so eventually the monks come to the Buddha. They present the case to the Buddha, and the Buddha calls Sati up. And the Buddha, typically, he doesn't immediately criticize Sati, but first he questions him and says, is it true that you hold such a view? Then the Buddha repeats the view, and Sati confirms this and says, it's exactly this way, Venerable Sir, that is my view. Okay, and now the Buddha asks a very important question that the monks themselves didn't ask. But this question brings out the real meaning of Sati's wrong view. It brings out the full implications of Sati's wrong view. The Buddha asks Sati, here I'm in the middle of the page, he asks, what is that consciousness? And Sati replies, it is that which speaks and feels and which experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. That with, in other words, that which experiences here and there the result of good and bad karma. And now by this definition of consciousness, Sati is almost explicitly identifying consciousness with the self, with an Atman. And that this is so will become clear if we go back to Sutta number 2, which we had studied quite some time ago, about a year and a half ago. We come to page 92, towards the bottom of the page. We have these six views that arise when the uninstructed common person reflects unwisely. And the sixth of these views is the view, it is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. And then this the proponent of this view goes on to say, but the self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. So in other words, in this sutta, sutta number 2, we see that this expression, the one who speaks and feels and experiences the result of actions, that notion is ascribed to a self which is taken to be permanent, eternal, and everlasting. And that is also the idea that is underlying the monk Sati's implicit understanding of the nature of consciousness. Consciousness for Sati is, though he's not calling it that, but consciousness is a self. It is a self which speaks, feels, experiences the result of karma, and it is a self which continues on from life to life, runs on, wanders on through the round of rebirths. And probably for Sati, even though he doesn't say this, it is a self that will continue to exist eternally.
Uncle, I'm not clear on, does he misunderstand the Buddha's teaching? Does he know he's in conflict with the Buddha's teaching? Does he think he's teaching something else?
It's quite clear that he misunderstands the Buddha's teaching, yeah. He misunderstands it. It seems to me that he must know that it's been made clear to him that he's misunderstood it, because the monks have presented arguments against his position, and he's just refused to accept those arguments.
And so many times in the suttas, there's some sort of monastic or ascetic who is saying, I'm teaching the true Dharma. And he doesn't seem to be saying that necessarily.
I'm teaching.
You know, they're setting themselves up as a teacher in opposition to the Buddha.
Well, he is not doing that because he is a bhikkhu, he is a Buddhist monk. So he wouldn't set himself up as a teacher in opposition to the Buddha. But he is thinking that, you see, because he is saying, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, so he thinks he understands the Dhamma correctly, even though the monks have, in a group, they've gone to him, and these would probably be monks who have established a reputation as being reliable interpreters of the teaching. And so it's probably pretty clear that he's being sort of somewhat stubborn and perverse in his insistence on that view. This is called Sandhitika Paramasa. In English it comes out, adhering stubbornly to one's own view and rejecting it with difficulty. Okay, then the Buddha says, misguided man, a foolish man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way? So it's clear that the Buddha is now saying that I've never taught the Dhamma in this way to anyone. And have I not stated in many ways consciousness to be dependently arisen? And without a condition, there is no origination of consciousness. And this will be, in a sense, the theme of this whole sutta. This idea is going to be approached from at least three major angles in the sutta. This theme of the dependent origination of consciousness. Okay, and then the Buddha goes on to say, this is the kind of reproach that here I would, oh, I should have inverted that in the revised edition. Change the wording a little bit. But you, misguided man, by your wrong grasp, that should come first, by your wrong grasp have misrepresented us and injured yourself and stored up much demerit, for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. You see, the Buddha doesn't mind if somebody has doubts or questions, or even if somebody misunderstands the teaching. But in this case, this person has been obstinately and persistently insisting on his interpretation. And then the Buddha goes on to question the monks and to show that when the monks are questioned, they confirm that in their view, the Buddha has always taught that consciousness is dependently arisen, and that without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. Okay, and now with the section called the conditionality of consciousness, this I would call the first demonstration of the dependent origination of consciousness. There'll be three demonstrations, or three ways in which the dependent arising of consciousness is demonstrated. The first demonstrates the dependent arising of consciousness. I would call it the dependent arising of consciousness through, I'll use the expression, concurrent conditions. That is, through conditions that exist along with, roughly simultaneous with, consciousness. I say roughly simultaneous with, or maybe contemporaneous with, since it's not exact momentary simultaneity. There's little differences in time. Okay, we're in paragraph 8 now. Okay, and taking it from this angle, consciousness is reckoned or designated by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. Okay, when consciousness arises dependent on the eye and forms, that's visible forms, it is reckoned as eye consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the ear and sounds, it is reckoned as ear consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the nose and odors, it is reckoned as nose consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the tongue and flavors or taste, it is reckoned as tongue consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the body and tangibles or tactile sensations, it is reckoned as body consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the mind and mind objects or mental phenomena, it is reckoned as mind consciousness. Okay, so we have two types of conditions, necessary conditions for the arising of consciousness. Okay, now when we use the expression or the word consciousness, you see, we take consciousness as a kind of abstract term, and then we turn it into something concrete as existing on its own, as though there is a consciousness apart from particular types of consciousness. And then we can glorify this and get a concept of a universal consciousness, a unitary consciousness, the divine, all-pervading consciousness. But according to the Buddha's teaching, when we speak of consciousness, we always raise the question, what kind of consciousness? that consciousness doesn't exist in the abstract as a kind of universal entity, but there are always particular types of consciousness. It's either a vision, an eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, or a mind consciousness. Consciousness is always one of these six types of consciousness. And then these six types of consciousness exist in dependence upon many conditions. But of the many conditions, from one angle, there are two types of conditions that are the most important for designating any type of consciousness. Those conditions, one is, we call it the internal base, that is the base pertaining to one's own person, and that is also called the sense faculty, that faculty through which consciousness arises. Okay, now what unites or unifies all of these types of consciousness is a similar function. That function is, we use the word cognizing an object, knowing an object, being aware of an object. Okay, but that knowing, that awareness, that cognizing is always of a particular type. The particular type is what is determined by the sense faculty, the sense base through which that act of knowing, that act of cognizing takes place. Only if there's something, I don't, unless there's something unclear that I said, otherwise it isn't a discussion period right now. Okay, now, the internal sense bases, I've said this previously, but I'll repeat it, are not the gross physical organs, but they are the particular types of matter generally located within these physical organs which have the capacity to respond to particular types of sense data. So that what we call the eye is not the eyeball itself, but it would be the type of sensitive matter located someplace within here that is able to respond to light and to transform light into visual images of the world. Similarly, the ear is not these two flappy things, but something located inside the ear channel that can turn vibrations of air into meaningful sounds. Okay, and so we have the internal sense base, the sense faculties, and then corresponding to them, the sense objects, visible forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects. And now the case with mind consciousness, the mind base, mental phenomena, it's a little different than with the others, because the mind consciousness is not restricted to its own class of objects. The other five types of consciousness can only take their own objects. Eye consciousness can only take forms. One doesn't see sounds, one doesn't taste colors. Though some people back in the 1960s when they used to take LSD, they say they taste colors and hear smells. But without support of those types of substances, one doesn't sense other types of objects. But mind consciousness is able to do that. Mind consciousness is on a perpetual trip, one could say. Mind consciousness can take the objects of the other sense faculties . For example, if one is comparing two shades of blue to see which one wants to use to paint a room, it's eye consciousness that brings in the colors. Eye consciousness that takes in the two shades of blue. But it is mind consciousness that compares these two colors and considers which would be more satisfactory as a color for this room. So mind consciousness makes that judgment. Okay, so we have these six types of consciousness, each with its own sense base, its own type of object. Okay, and then in addition to the five types of sense objects, the mind consciousness takes its own type of objects. What are the objects of mind consciousness called the dhammas or mental phenomena? They would be all types of ideas, images, abstract qualities, things that cannot be reduced to objects of the senses, of the other five senses. Okay, maybe, Jim, now you had the question.
Where does intuition fall into consciousness?
Oh, intuition would be a function of the mind consciousness. Like just about all of these higher mental functions would be functions of mind consciousness. The five types of sense consciousness, their function is pretty much just to bring in their respective types of sensory objects. Then every type of higher mental function based on those sensory phenomena and those that take place independent of them would be functions of mind consciousness. So mind consciousness is much, much more complex, much more variegated than the five types of sense consciousness. Excuse me?
You say cognizability and awareness are pretty much one and the same?
I'm using these words to capture, I call it the general function of consciousness, and it's pretty difficult to get one word that really does the trick in English. So I'm just bringing in several words, but each word has its own particular nuance to it. And so if one just takes hold of that one word apart from the others, it could lead to misunderstanding, which is why I'm bringing in several words. I think I used that which is knows, cognizes, is aware, what experiences. You have to bring all of them in together. Okay, then the Buddha illustrates this diversity of consciousness with the simile of a fire. Okay, he says that just as fire is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it burns, this must have to do something with particularity of Indian ways of expression, since I think in English we usually just pretty much speak about a fire. We don't specify fires very much, at least I don't. Okay, but using the language of his time, he said, when a fire burns dependent on logs, it is reckoned as a log fire. When fire burns dependent on faggots, it is reckoned as a faggot fire. When fire burns dependent on grass, it is reckoned as a grass fire. When fire burns dependent on cow dung, it is reckoned as a cow dung fire. When fire burns dependent on chaff, it is reckoned as a chaff fire. When fire burns dependent on rubbish, it is reckoned as a rubbish fire. So too, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it arises. And then he repeats that same passage about how consciousness arises depending on its faculty and its object. And now, I should say some words about how consciousness occurs according to the Buddha's teaching. According to the Buddha's teaching, on each occasion of experience, each occasion of experience, according to the Buddha's teaching, is a different occasion of consciousness. And one can dissect an occasion of experience as we normally experience it, not only logically, but even experientially, through the practice of mindfulness, through attending mindfully to experience with subtler and subtler levels of mindfulness. As one attends to experience, one sees that it is composed or constituted of extremely brief, extremely rapid occasions of consciousness. Occasions of experience which occur so swiftly that one can hardly detect their individual occurrence. And as the power of concentration, samadhi, the power of mindfulness become more refined, one is able to fine-tune one's observation of the stream of experience to these subtler levels so that one can see how it's sort of like bringing in a microscope onto the process of experience and see how it is constituted of just acts of consciousness arising and passing very, very swiftly. And of course, the Buddha has used the power of his sabbanyutanjana, his omniscient knowledge, to observe the process of experience even at the subtlest levels and to see how consciousness is just this act of cognition occurring, they say in the text, in the time that it takes for a flash of lightning to occur. Millions of acts of consciousness have arisen and passed away. And so each act of consciousness arises, occurring very, very swiftly. It arises, along with it comes a whole bundle of associated mental factors. When it arises, it's always based upon a material foundation, which is also undergoing rapid change. It's taking an object, often a physical object, which is also undergoing rapid change. And then consciousness passes away. But when it passes away instantaneously, immediately another act of consciousness arises. And that passes away. Another arises and passes away. And as each act of consciousness arises and passes away, it conditions the arising of the next act of consciousness. So each act of consciousness is arising conditioned not only by its sense base and its object, but it's also conditioned in a very significant way by the preceding act of consciousness. And in this way, because each preceding act of consciousness conditions the arising of the next act of consciousness, in this way, there is a continuity to experience. So that even though each act of consciousness is distinct, even though each act of consciousness is discrete, there is a continuity of experience. So that our mental life is not just a series of disconnected, incoherent jerks of irrational experience, but there is continuity, consistency, order, meaning within this constantly changing, discontinuous stream, or better, series of occasions of experience. And it is because there is continuity within the stream of consciousness that consciousness is able, out of this mass of experience that it is sucking in, out of this mass of experience, that it is able to constitute a meaningful, coherent world for itself. I should have said a meaningful, coherent world before. I hope the NSA isn't listening. Okay, now an interesting question comes up, and this is where many people might get somewhat misled and think, okay, you look at this passage here. Consciousness is conditioned, right? Okay, five sense consciousnesses conditioned by their bases, their objects. So no base, no consciousness. Mind consciousness conditioned by the mind base, mind objects. No mind base, no mind objects, no mind consciousness. Okay. Body dies. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. That's obvious. No five consciousnesses. And it seems, of course, pretty obvious on that occasion. Body dies, there's no mind. No mind consciousness. So the Buddha is obviously saying everything comes to an end at death. And Sati's problem is he was insisting that there's some continuity beyond death. Right? So the point of the sutta is that everything comes to an end at death. Anybody have a different opinion? How to get around that one?
Before you talk of the Bhavanga.
Yeah, but that's an Abhidhamma concept.
Is there any canonical support for the Bhavanga?
Trying to think whether there's sutta support for it. There's not very clear sutta support for it.
Doesn't the final moment of consciousness death condition the first moment?
Again, that's an abhidharmic way of explaining. There are passages that come, I think of some passages in the Sanyutta Nikaya, which speak about, they're rather obscure, but they speak about, they make it quite clear that consciousness is what continues beyond death. And there are many, many suttas in which the Buddha speaks about existing beyond death, so there's no support at all for the idea that existence, personal existence, comes to an end at death. The Buddha speaks about how one who does bad deeds with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, a bad destination, the lower world and hell. The one who does good with the breakup of the body after death, she is reborn in a higher world, the happy world, the heavenly world. So there's clear recognition in sutta after sutta of rebirth. Okay, it seems that this became a problem that the various Buddha schools had to deal with. The way, I guess, most Buddha schools, including the Theravada school, dealt with it is by taking a type of mind consciousness, a mano-vijnana, as that which becomes the vehicle, what I call the channel or vehicle for the rebirth process. And now, what's called mind here, is not a physical entity. It's not the brain or the physical nervous system, but it is the mind, actually, according to the commentaries, that is the bhavanga, and that serves as the support for the arising of mind consciousness, for clear, I call this clear conceptual consciousness. Okay, and so, according to the way this is handled in the Abhidhamma, the Theravada Abhidhamma, is to recognize a type of mind consciousness, which is the bhavanga, which it occurs, okay, within the human existence, on all the occasions when there is not clear consciousness taking place. It's a kind of passive stream of subliminal consciousness. At death, that bhavanga plays the role or the function of the death consciousness. And then that same type of consciousness springs up the next moment based upon a new physical organism as the rebirth consciousness. It is a mind consciousness with its own object. It's not an outer object, an external object, but it takes its own inner object. And then that type of consciousness will continue throughout the course of a life whenever there is no type of clear consciousness of any of the other types occurring. And so that type of consciousness will continue on maintaining, it serves as a kind of underlying, I use the expression channel or thread that maintains the continuity of personal existence. But the bhavanga, this is the important point, the bhavanga consciousness is not a single consciousness that retains its identity throughout time. But the bhavanga consciousness is just a type of consciousness. So at, say, this moment, right now, just hypothetically, one moment of bhavanga is occurring, or one bhavanga consciousness is occurring. And now, 3 seconds later, another bhavanga consciousness is occurring. Each bhavanga consciousness arises, ceases. Then another bhavanga consciousness arises, ceases. Another one arises and ceases. And so the bhavanga consciousness, the bhavanga consciousness, bhavanga consciousnesses, it's easier to use the Pali, bhavanga chittas, are always arising, ceasing, arising, ceasing. Then when an impressive sense object impinges on our sense faculties, then the bhavanga will get cut off and the sensory consciousness will arise, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Or if a strong mental object will arise, then thinking, pondering, imagining, judging, intuiting, whatever. And then when that stops, then the mind goes back into the bhavanga. In fact, according to this particular model, this Abhidhamma model, even right now while I'm speaking, right now while you're listening, hundreds and thousands of times our minds are going down into the bhavanga, coming back up, going down, coming up. But it's occurring so quickly that we're not aware of it. It's somewhat like a computer screen. This is what I'm told. I've never observed it. But they say that when you're looking at a computer screen, it's constantly disintegrating and reconstituting itself, disintegrating, reconstituting itself. But you're sitting there reading it. Maybe you're reading some text. Somebody tells you that screen is dissolving. Somebody says, don't look at the screen. Don't read the screen. You'll ruin your eyes. It's constantly disintegrating and reconstituting itself before your eyes. You say, what are you talking about? I'm just sitting here. It's just simple text, constantly remaining present before my eyes. You better go see an eye doctor or a psychiatrist. But in fact, it's true. Or at least if what they tell me is true. the image, it's hundreds of times, thousands of times a second, disappearing, reappearing. Is that true, some specialist? 60 times? 60 cycles per second. Yeah. So the Bhavanga is much, much quicker than 60 seconds per cycle, than 660 seconds per cycle. Okay, any questions or comments?
Well, I was at death, with the disintegration of the brain, as the seeds of consciousness, it implies that there's no base for consciousness and so it would end.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the immaterial realm,
yeah,
there's no physical base for consciousness.
That is right.
So it's not necessary to have that physical base.
That is true. In the sensuous realm of existence, in the form realm, consciousness depends upon a physical base, which, according to the Buddhist tradition, it's called the heart base. But we can take this just perhaps as a metaphor for the nervous system. If you want, I'm rather stubborn. I believe that the base of consciousness is really the heart. I'll tell you my analogy in a moment. In the formless realm, there's no physical form. And so consciousness in the physical realm doesn't depend upon a physical base, but it occurs without any material or physical base. What it's like there, how consciousness occurs without a physical base, without any physical organs, without any sensory objects, what it's like, tune in next week, but no coming attractions. I don't know. Now my analogy for the way consciousness arises from the heart is, really does have the heart base, but we can still accept the current physiological model of the brain as being very important for the functioning of consciousness. Again, I will take the computer as my analogy. Okay, we're working a computer, somebody tells you, what is the real, you say, the nervous system of the computer? What is it that determines how all of the programs of the computer function, how the operating system functions? Where is that, all of that lodged? What would one say? The central processing unit? Let's not be too sophisticated. We'll say the central processing unit. That's where the heart, suppose the hard disk is there, a central processing unit, all of that together. Okay, that is like the brain. But if somebody says, then the power of the computer must come from the central processing unit, right? Say no. The electricity doesn't come from the central processing unit. The electricity comes from some source, some power source of power supply. get that notebook out of my sight. It's ruining my analogy. Okay, even with a notebook, yeah, the battery is separate from, right, the battery, in fact, that's better than this desktop computer. The battery is not the processing unit. The battery is separate from the processing unit. The battery is something different. Or even with the desktop computer, we can say the power source, it's different from the processing unit. Okay, so the way I would see it, the power source for the computer, whether battery or external source of electricity, that is the heart base, which doesn't mean that it's this physical organ is the thing that pumps, that is the base for consciousness. But there's a very, very subtle type of physical phenomena here. And it is from this that the energy arises through which consciousness comes into the organism, and consciousness comes in through that up into the nervous system, into the brain, and the brain does all of the processing through which all the cognitive functions take place. And this is why when brain death takes place, it doesn't mean the end of the stream of consciousness, vijnana. But the vijnana, the stream of consciousness, it goes, settles into the heart base, and it will remain there until the heart stops functioning. When the heart stops functioning, then that's the end of the life. Any further questions? Jim?
When you talk of formless, is timelessness part of formless?
Part of the formless existence. Existence in the formless realm is not timeless, but the time scale is vastly extended beyond our time scale. Okay, this is the scale and the formless realm. In our particular physical universe, speak about its beginning with the Big Bang. They say, I think the current speculation is that the Big Bang started 17 billion years ago. I think that's the present figure, 15 to 17 billion years ago. The universe is expanding outwards, outwards, outwards. There's some uncertainty among scientists whether it's to continue expanding indefinitely or whether it depends upon the amount of dark matter in the universe. If there's a certain amount, then the gravitational force will be sufficient to stop the process of expansion so that eventually it slows down and initiates a process of contraction, so that eventually contracts and collapses upon itself. According to the Buddha's teaching, in fact, the Buddha doesn't make any statements about the amount of dark matter in the universe, but they speak about the universe is going through these cycles, or this world system is going through cycles of expansion and contraction. And so, in this model, contraction will take place and the world system will contract upon itself. Okay, if this is going 17 billion years, I don't know how much longer it will continue to expand. But let's suppose that tomorrow it reaches the maximum point of expansion, which it won't, and then starts collapsing on itself, taking an equal amount of time, 17 billion years, 34 billion years minimum. But let's round that off. It won't stop tomorrow, so let's give it 50 billion years as one cycle. Okay, that is one cosmic aeon. Now, in the formless realm, the lowest level, and there are four levels in the formless realm, the lowest level, the lifespan consists of 20,000 of those. 20,000 big bangs and big collapses. The next level is 40,000, next level is 60,000, then the fourth level, they say, is 84,000. I don't know why they added 4,000. It's something like tax breaks for the extra rich. They get an extra 4,000 years. I think because 84,000 was an auspicious number in Indian cosmology. But maybe it's 80,000, and then they just upped it to 84,000. So for those beings, the problem in that realm is that it seems to be timeless, it seems to be eternal, so that and the beings there spend so much of their time in this deep, very peaceful samadhi, and they have no sensory experience, so they're not distracted by the changes in form, sounds, which usually signal to us the passage of time. Like if one goes into a sensory deprivation unit, one doesn't have such a clear sense of the passage of time, because it's movement of forms and sounds that signify, or that signal passage of time. So that they think that they are there for eternity. But then eventually the time comes when, I can't say an alarm clock goes off because there's no hearing. Nobody sort of taps them on the shoulder because there's no shoulder to be tapped. But eventually they get somehow the message gets through to them that the time has come to put an end to the holiday, and then they have to sign off and drop away from that realm and take rebirth someplace else.
So in the formless timeless, in Buddha, in enlightenment, when there's no original dependation on the mind, if you would, or in form, senses, and all of that, there's no dependent origination on any of those points. Don't you really come to the formless and timeless state that you're talking about? In consciousness as we know it, quote unquote, we know it really doesn't exist in this
form. Yeah, the state of enlightenment, this is somewhat different from the formless realm of existence. I was talking about what are called the formless realms of existence within the Buddhist cosmos, which has the three realms of existence. Which are the, because it was originally George who asked that question with reference to, we have the sense sphere realm, the form realm, the formless realm. So he asked that question with reference to the formless realm. And then I answered originally with reference to the formless realm. And then, in that formless realm, there are no physical forms. You know, no solid forms, no visible forms, but it is a realm, or it's a set of realms of existence.
Yes, I wonder if they know if this applies, but in the Prajnaparamita, in the Heart Sutra, it exists, it doesn't exist, so there it is. So.
This is different from the formless realms, and so I was just answering with reference to the formless realms. Okay, I think we have to stop now. Our time is up. Because we are still in a sensory realm of existence. And in a monastery in which there's also a time limit. Okay, so we end by dedicating the merit, sharing the merit with the devas who are very close to the human realm of existence, the earth realm, the earth-dwelling devas, the buddhas, the yakshas, and all other beings who are able to participate in this act of merit, wishing that they will protect the Buddha's sasana, the Buddha's teaching, protect the world from, protect all the forces of goodness in the world, and protect all beings from harm and suffering. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chaham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.